listening to me playing my flute inside the Anglo-American Telescope at the Siding Spring Observatory in the Warrumbungles, New South Wales, about 4 years ago. In the chamber down underneath the telescope, it has fantastic acoustics. I added in the whale songs later. And also, behind us, you've got a song called Stars, which is my impression of the stars, done on grand piano in 1998, and then a song called Constellations of the Southern Hemisphere. Charlie Brown goes to Proxima Centauri with Zach Vilmer on drums, recorded in Atlanta, December, on the winter solstice, 1999. Greetings from the universe. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson. This is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 322, being recorded here on the morning of Saturday, the 23rd of May, from northern Tasmania. It's a beautiful, crystal clear morning. Second morning in a row where we had a temperature of at least 0 Celsius and possibly lower, with my little bird bath frozen solid with about 8 or 10 centimeters of ice. Very, very interesting experiencing the beauty of the ice divas. Beautiful small flock of black cockatoos flew right over while I was burning my sage this morning too, which was very much of an honor. This show is entitled On Being an Astronomer, Honoring the Star Nations and Our Cosmic Context. This is a very huge topic, probably almost as big as the concept of space, which I covered in a show a few weeks ago called Space, Are We There Yet? Ever since I was about 12 years old, I've really been an astronomer. I really fell in love with the stars and the heavens. In the summer of 1968, when I had this really amazing kind of spiritual epiphany experience, and possibly what stimulated the whole thing was when my dad came back from a trip that he had gone on for a few weeks traveling as an educator. And he came back and he gave me 2 books, one of which was Immanuel Wielikowski's book, Worlds in Collision. And the other one was called Field Guide to the Stars. It was a little book, not a lot bigger than the palm of your hand. And it had all kinds of little maps of the heavens and all the celestial objects, the planets and the clusters and the galaxies and the views from the seasons of the year and tables and charts and stuff like that. And I was reading these books, and this was late. Would have been late July. And one night it was just getting dark, and I went out in the backyard and just looked up at the sky, and I felt as if a magical energy of some kind just kind of came down around and enveloped me. And not physically, but it was like an awareness. But it was like this enchanted, mystical strand or sudden moment of a change in my consciousness that I went, it was like at the opening of the doors of wonder, of enchantment, of the whole universe. And it was like I all of a sudden became aware of the vastness of the universe and the magicalness of who is there or who the universe is. I mean, I've tried for many decades to verbalize this experience, and I really can't, but it was like an awakening into the cosmic beauty and awesomeness and eternity and infinity, but also a sense of that somebody's there. That, and this wasn't really, I guess it truly was a religious experience, but not really. I didn't think of it that way, but this is what a truly religious experience would be. But I don't like that word. It was a spiritual transformation and awakening, or a remembering. I don't know. None of these words really fit. You know, like I could play music and show you some art that expresses this. And that's really what I've been doing my whole life ever since then. But the result was that I kind of fell in love with the stars and all things celestial and astronomical right then. And I had binoculars, and I started going out and identifying the planets and the clusters and the galaxies and throughout the different seasons of the year. And then I got a nice 35mm camera and started doing photography. My earliest photography was like astronomical photography of the crescent moon and Venus. And then I got a telescope a year later, a Unitron 2.4-inch refractor, through which I could see the moons of Jupiter and a lot of craters on the moon and the rings of the moons of Saturn, the Pleiades, and all these different things. And I'd get up all hours of the night looking at the stars and doing photography and stuff, and even to where I'd fall asleep in class, even though I was the straight A number one student, and I still made all A's, but I was just so in love with the stars. And then when I went to college, I was actually going to be an astronomer, until I realized that astronomers as a whole don't really do all that much looking at the stars. They do mathematics and physics and computer stuff and charts and tables and stuff like that, and sit at desks. But I wanted to look at the stars. I wanted to look through the big telescopes and be out with my family of the star nations. So then, while I was in college struggling to deal with being a physics major, I then became enchanted by the dolphins through the work of Dr. John Lilly, whose work rang the same chord in me as had been rung that night when I was 12, a calling from the stars and from the dolphins, which was related somehow in a way that I had no idea of what that connection might be, but I could feel that it was coming from the same thing. So then I fell in love with the dolphin work and Dr. Lilly's idea of thinking of the dolphins as an extraterrestrial intelligence. Not that they aren't from here, but it would be a similar, that maybe they aren't from here in the sense that they're beings that whose consciousness is the same as that of their fellow beings or ancestors who might be in different star systems made of water-based life, planets with water. And this is a thread that's brought me to where I am right now. It's the thread that brought me down under in the year 2000. And on July 1st, it'll be 20 years since I first set foot in Australia. So it's like the heavens have always been kind of like a canvas for the projection of the human imagination, in the same way that the ocean is. The vastness of the ocean and its depths that we don't know anything about, and the vastness of the heavens, we look up to the stars. What that's always represented, the stars, is like the ultimate frontier, the ultimate distance that we could go, the ultimate breadth of our perception and how far we can see. And I think that humans have always looked on the heavens as representing the unknown. So people have always looked at the skies as an abode of the gods, maybe the planets and the stars, and ancient people attributed all kinds of godlike attributes to ancient people would have thought of all the celestial objects probably as beings or gods, deities, different possible where visitors might come from to visit the earth. Also, the origin of influences, whether spiritual or real world influences, in the sense of like the sunlight coming from the sky, the seasons, the cycles of time, day and night. And then also, it's very interesting that we have the word disaster that in Latin means a bad star. So people for a long time would have been aware of, I don't know if bad star was originally a supernova, but people would sort of form kind of synchronistic constellations of association between like events that they might see in the heaven. For example, the appearance of a supernova or a comet or something like that. And they associate that with something that happens here on the earth. And so I don't know if they attributed causality to it. Anyway, the whole point is the heavens have always been sort of the ultimate projection screen for the human imagination. And then as we've come to actually believe that we understand what is really there, stars, planets, galaxies, comets and asteroids, all different kind of objects, nebulae, the whole, all our different models of the universe itself, and really, we've only been able to sort of go a certain distance, and this is kind of like the distinction I make between whether I'm talking about space, like I did in my show, Space, Are We There Yet? And then the astronomical perspective. Space kind of implies that it's some place that we think that we're going to go, or that in reality we already are, but astronomy implies sort of like the perception or observation of our family in the universe, but without necessarily going there or influencing it or engineering it or anything like that. So this show is about the astronomical perspective of honoring and being aware of our cosmic context and our cosmic family of life. Entire academic disciplines exist that study maybe the anthropology of archaeoastronomy, how different cultures and people have looked to the heavens and worshipped the different celestial beings and deities and things like that. And then we've got the whole calendrical and temporal relationship of human cultures in the sense of astronomical time, how we measure and perceive cycles of time, whether it's the day-night cycle, the lunar cycle, the seasons of the year, the sort of the passage, the precession of the equinoxes, and really sophisticated systems like the Mayan calendar that seem to measure spans of time not by the motion of astronomical bodies but by the qualitative shifts in the energetic emanations coming from the center of the galaxy. Now that's very interesting in itself, and apparently I've come to sort of be a bit suspicious of a lot of the work of Jose Arguelles and also Carl Kalaman, two of the top quote-unquote Mayan scholars that have talked about a lot of this stuff, but not knowing any Mayans myself, but my friend Mark Elmy, who's living in Guatemala now, does know some. He's been sort of guiding me on this, helping me have correct names for like what I used to refer to as the Hunab Ku, which was Jose Arguelles is named for the center of the galaxy. But measuring time in terms of qualitative changes of energetic emanations and giving the, say, like, for example, from here to here, over X many hundreds or thousands of years, we're in the period when this particular deity is having his influence, and then that has a name. And then it shifts to the period of time when this deity is having his influence, and it's sort of like, and as I understand it, there's like 17 different ones of these in to the Mayans. Very, very challenging to try to understand this kind of thing, but no less real than our current mainstream astronomical astrophysical worldview. Another extremely important relationship between humanity and astronomical awareness is for navigation, how the, for example, the Polynesian navigators were able to traverse the entire Pacific Ocean and go to places that they possibly didn't even know existed. I mean, this is a very multidimensional and possibly even sort of neo-shamanic process that is not all that well understood. And then there's the whole concept that's been huge in my life in recent years, is the whole notion of astronomy as understood or practiced by beings who are not human, specifically the whales and dolphins. This makes a lot of sense to me, and I'd like to thank Tui Allen, a New Zealand author who wrote a book called Ripple. And it's a novel about dolphins living on the earth millions of years ago before there were people. And the dolphins, to her, are astronomers. And they don't just look at the stars. They actually have sort of like out-of-body experiences where they actually sort of astrally travel to different star systems and stuff. And this was a really cool idea that made a lot of sense to me, and has since been borne out in many, many, many different ways. The most powerful of which was when, in late October of 2015, I had a telepathic transmission from a pod of dolphins I'd just been swimming with like every day for a week, and it was an image transmitted directly into my mind, and I know it was from them. I've never had an experience like this before, and it was an image or an impression of what a comet or asteroid might look like for the split second as it's passing through the atmosphere on a trajectory directly towards the observer, as if to say that their ancestors had witnessed something like this and lived to tell, but also that they were telling me that something like this was going to happen again, and my impression was quite soon. This is something I've talked about many, many, many times. So all this stuff relates to honoring the star nations in our cosmic context. Like, that's what I always like about astronomy, and especially, for example, astronomer Carl Sagan's TV show Cosmos. It gave a perspective on where we are in space and time and how truly minute we are in this grand scheme. I mean, of course, it's all based on our perception of things, our models, our map of the universe, which, even though we're a part of it and we're receiving energies and emanations constantly, I mean, how could we not? But I mean, when you look at a star, you've actually got photons from that star that have, in our current model, they've been traveling for hundreds of thousands of years to get from the star to you. So I mean, this is a way that we think about it. But so we're being impacted and connected with energies and emanations from all parts of the universe at every time. This is just at sort of like at optical wavelengths. So when you think of our models of how big the universe is, even if it is just in our mind, it's huge. And to think of how, on the scale that we've created, how infinitesimally microscopic we are as these, we're humans are one species of life among billions on a planet, Mother Earth, orbiting a star, Teoa, the Hopi name, in a spiral arm of one of an infinite number of galaxies. And so, I mean, that alone, if you just try to dwell on that, you can't really get your head around how tiny we are. Yet, paradoxically, to us, we're like the pinnacle of intelligence in the universe. But, you know, I mean, to me, this is one of the most ironic contradictions in the whole mentality of modern humanity, is the juxtaposition of these two ideas and how we've come to think of ourselves. We go like, oh look, are we alone in the universe? Is there anybody else out there? Any other intelligent life forms like us that are destroying their planet and waging war on life and on each other with every possible thing that we can do? I mean, how, isn't that evidence of that our species is insane, that we've even come to have beliefs like this? So anyway, an awareness of the stars, you don't have to study them. Just being aware, going out and looking at the stars and letting your mind go and realizing that we really don't know who or what they are, is just, to me, ever more mind-blowing. I never get tired of looking at the stars. Like, for example, last night, when you look at the sky now around midnight, you see the constellation Scorpio and Sagittarius, which are very dominant directly overhead near the zenith. And in between the tail of Scorpio and the spout of Sagittarius is a big fuzzy spot. And it's actually Messier 7, I believe it's called. It's a star cluster. But very close to there is what astronomers call Sagittarius A, or the Mayans call it Rukuxkash, which is the center of the galaxy that I used to call the Huneb Q. So this is actually, astronomers believe it's a black hole, but apparently the center of the galaxy would be so bright that if it wasn't obscured by all these clouds of dust, that it would cast a shadow just like a full moon. So this is the center of our galaxy. This is what's coming overhead right now at this time of year. And you can also see, sort of along the plane of the Milky Way, is, and it consists of Alpha and Beta Centauri, which are the pointers, and then Crux Australis, or the Southern Cross. These two little constellations and groups of stars together, which, depending on the angle you're looking at, it kind of looks like a small version of the constellation Leo. This forms the body of Dinawan, the emu in the Milky Way ancestor, whose ceremony happens at the very sacred Uluru of the East Coast Nations called Mount Yango, that I visited three times last year. That they have their ceremony there in May, which they probably already done. So that's really cool. You've also got the time that the Maori call Matariki, which happens in June. That's when Matariki is their name for the Pleiades, what the Japanese call Subaru, the seven sisters in the constellation, the shoulder of the constellation Taurus, the bull. And so Matariki is when the Pleiades are overhead in June. And it's very interesting that the constellation Taurus is the radiance for the two meteor showers that are believed to originate from fragments of comet Encke. That's E-N-C-K-E. I finally learned how to pronounce it from my friends from Germany. Encke is the comet that has the shortest period that we know, 3.2 years, but it's believed to be only a remnant of a much larger supercomet that has been involved in many impact events on the Earth, including possibly the event from about 13,000 years ago that caused the lower Dryas cooling event, and possibly the Chicxulub event from 65 million years ago that was involved with the extinction sequence that led to the demise of the dinosaurs. This is as it's believed. And I'm very lucky to have been in touch with Victor Klub and Bill Napier, the two legendary comet astronomers that have formulated the idea of mass extinction events being triggered by comet and asteroid impacts before Lewis and Walter Alvarez kind of stole their thunder in 1982. But so this is when I look up in the sky now around midnight, I see Scorpio and Sagittarius in the center of the galaxy. I see the pointers and the Southern Cross and the South Celestial Pole. You also see the large and small Magellanic clouds, which are the two closest galaxies to the Earth. They're not spirals like Milky Way or Andromeda. They're kind of irregular galaxies, but they're both only about 400,000 to 500,000 light years away, which makes them very close neighbors in an astronomical perspective. But so the whole star nations, that's what I think of as our family. It's kind of like Ohana Moana is our family of life in the ocean. So the star nations is our family of everybody in the sky, and it includes all the planets in our solar system, all the meteors and the comets and asteroids, and the two comets that have been discovered in the past year. There's no end to trying to catalog all the objects that we can see or that we know about, and this is just that are visible at optical wavelengths. You've also got the whole discipline of radio astronomy and how many different sort of like whole different spectrum of objects that, and even things that are visible only at X-ray wavelengths or gamma rays. Then you've got the emanations that we're constantly interacting with and being exposed to that have been an integral part of the evolution of life on Earth, not only from the sun, but energies from the other stars, from interstellar and intergalactic plasma. And this is the sort of more or less constant background of energy. And you've got the cosmic microwave background that they say it's a residual leftover from the Big Bang, but who knows what really happened or is happening now. But you've also got the occasional outburst of not only mass ejections from the sun, but also the occasional supernova that might come by and blast us with a bunch of energy. And so whenever we see it, that's just when the light arrived here. That doesn't tell us when it actually happened. So this is another thing, the whole idea of time and distance as a function of the speed of light. This is all sort of Einsteinian relativity theory. So all this stuff, everything I'm saying, and I apologize for this show being a bit kind of chaotic. I'm recording it under less than ideal circumstances here, the bit of human disruption. But the point is to try to create and maintain a sense of wonder and a sense of the perspective on where we are in the universe, our spatiotemporal coordinates, and how small we are. I did a song called The Insignificance of Humanity that I'll probably close this show with. But, and then there's also the entire discipline of astrology, which I was never that big of a fan of astrology, because you'd see the horoscope in the newspaper and it always kind of sounded the same, fairly nebulous kind of things that could apply to anybody any day. But then when you think about the planets, for example, in our solar system as being beings in the same sense of Gaia, Mother Earth, each one would have its own kind of like planetary personality, its own energetic characteristics and stuff. And even if you don't buy into that perspective, they are physical presences and would exert, in the same sense that the moon has a lot to do with tides and different kind of physical and mechanical effects of the ocean and even on the continents here on Earth, and then all living beings would be affected by these lunar influences. The planets would exert similar kind of influences, only at a lesser level, even just from gravitational and mechanical things. And so when you add in these kind of influences, I don't think it necessarily determines who somebody's going to be at the time they're born, but they are constantly shifting influences, and influences of the different geometrical and spatial relationships between the planets, and how this might affect subtle variations in orbits, and how this kind of thing, orbital variations, could affect magnetic fields. Magnetic fields can affect how we think and process our information at the nervous system level. So I think it's all integrally related. And I think it's just really important to honor the full spectrum of who our Star Nation family is, beginning with everybody that we know and see up close, everybody that's come to Earth, whether it might be extraterrestrial visitors, or it might be meteors or comets and asteroids, or clouds of dust that we've passed through, or the tail of a comet, or the panspermia theory of life coming here, DNA being a form of extraterrestrial intelligence, or life coming here, the spores that Terrence McKenna talked about, or the idea that the origins of life might have come on a meteor. I mean, we just don't know. All of this is all these different kind of aspects of the astronomical perspective. And our cosmic context is what really gives us a sense of meaning, both in terms of scale, space and time, but also a sense of meaning in the sense of how sacred life is, how unique we are, because as far as we know for sure, we don't know any other planet or star system that harbors life as we know her. And on one hand, you'd think that the universe would be teeming with life on other planets. But then on the other hand, equally probable is that there may be none. I mean, I don't know, I'd probably tend to say in my own thinking that there probably would be planets and moons that have conditions for life, you know, given that our whole idea of, like, for example, the periodic table of the elements, that holds up, you know, like in the same sense that some ancient cultures might have, like, their whole conception of reality is different from ours, and their language, and not only why they communicate, but their ideas about time and space. And so the people might have thought that, like, for example, if someone goes away from you and you can't see them anymore, then they no longer exist. And then when they come back, then they exist again. I mean, that kind of thinking, we might call it primitive, but in a way it's true. Because if something is not in your immediate field of experience, then it exists. It still exists. Like people that you don't know exist, and we're still connected with them telepathically. I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's like we're only able to keep so much in our awareness at once. And to try to grasp the infinite dimension and complexity of the universe, both within and without, because really that we're talking both. When we look outward to the stars, we're really looking inward into our own minds, because what we're actually experiencing is our simulation of this infinite regress of astronomical time and distance. So anyway, when I look at the stars, which I do every night if it's clear, or in my art, this is the kind of stuff that goes through my mind. Everything that I've said in the show is kind of like encapsulated in what the stars mean to me. So I think that it one of the best things we can do is to go out and look at the stars and get away from electricity and from your computer screen and your mobile phone and your TV and people talking, and go and look at the stars and just let your mind go, let your mind fly out there. It was very interesting that my experience when I was 12 was in late July, and it was very significant to me that the ancient Egyptians put a lot of emphasis on the star Sirius, which is actually quite high in the sort of upper regions of the western sky. Now, when it gets dark, you see Sirius, and I stand at the river and do my Qigong, looking at Sirius every day in the evening, along with playing my flute to the platypus. And the other day, I actually felt like a wave of beautiful cosmic energy coming from Sirius. Of course, this was in my mind, but it was about a feeling of the love with which creation was made and is being made and maintained, and that the star Sirius is important. And so I read that the ancient Egyptians, their main celebration of the year was the heliacal rising of the star Sirius, which is when Sirius becomes visible again in either the morning or the evening, probably the evening, after being in conjunction with the sun for 70 days, during which time the energies of Sirius and the sun are aligned. And so they're sending their energies directly to us, maybe amplified. The energy of Sirius is amplified by the sun, comes to us. And so then when Sirius became visible again, this was also related to the flooding of the Nile. And this, the most powerful time, it had to do with the rebirth of Isis and the regeneration of life. And it was a cosmic link between the Earth and Sirius. And this, I always read that this was on July 23rd for a long time. But then I realized that the heliacal rising of Sirius is actually a window of time going all the way from mid-July into like mid to late August, depending on which hemisphere you're in and what your latitude is and longitude and stuff like that. And so the heliacal rising of Sirius is actually right during that window of time. It's when I had this very amazing experience that turned me on to the stars. And so that's always been very amazing to me. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson saying, go out and be with the star nations tonight, and let your mind go on a journey to infinity and back.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.